This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
We're going to start with a couple stories about energy politics and how countries are gaining enormous power by being able to control the flow of energy into other nations. We'll talk about the Middle East in a moment, but we begin with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which dramatically empowers Germany over other European nations. The United States has actually tried to prevent this project from being completed and was successful in doing so for a short time, until recently, that is. For this story, we will go to Richard.
Yes, the United States and Germany announced on July 21st that they'd come to an agreement over this Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Now, this pipeline was pretty much complete, very close to it. It was all set to go ahead anyway. President Donald Trump had done a ton to slow down, to even halt this pipeline, as it was very close to being completed. President Biden, we already reported on, stepped a lot of those sanctions back, which pretty much meant that this pipeline could be finished. And now he announces this deal where all the sanctions are lifted and it is allowed to go ahead basically with America's blessing now. And there's a number of things that I think are really remarkable about this. I think, you know, one is the decision behind this is basically a capitulation. You know, you had America's, the world's number one superpower, going up against Germany. And America was the one that surrendered. America was the one that blinked, which just it makes very little sense almost on paper. I mean, if you compare the size of their militaries and things like that, the size of their economies even, yet America was the one that surrendered. And that was very much, you know, what this was. This was, it's been announced as a deal, but it basically gives Germany everything they want. Anything that had any semblance of a tooth cutting through it was removed from this deal. So, for example, a clause that said that the gas would get cut off if Russia invaded their neighbors, that was removed. Germany said, no, we're not willing to accept that. So it's just some money for Ukraine, some kind of vague commitments that will be very easy for people to duck out of. So, you know, people clearly see what happened here. America threw Ukraine and Eastern Europe under the bus because it didn't want to break with Germany. You know, that's absolutely remarkable. Ambrose Evans Pritchard had an article about this in The Telegraph. And, you know, he said Washington and Berlin have together decided Ukraine's grim fate between them, with nobody at Kiev at the table, pretending that the stitch up is not a latter day Yalta. I mean, that's what this is. It's a surrender to Germany and to Russia, I guess. America was afraid, or the Biden administration was afraid, with a formal break with Germany. This keeps the relationship going, at least on paper, but it's now allowed Germany to completely overturn its relationship with Russia, the situation in Eastern Europe, and America's allowing that then to continue with their blessing.
If you could, Richard, just give a brief explanation of why Nord Stream 2 is so concerning, why Donald Trump was so intent on preventing it from proceeding, and what this means now with Germany able to go forward without any hindrance.
Yeah, so I'll start that by just talking about another bit of recent news, and this is where Russia has been selling less gas to Europe over the last few months. Typically, during the summer, this is where you buy more gas than you need and you fill up your reservoirs so you've got extra gas supplies. Russia hasn't been doing that this year. They've been refusing, they've been only selling them enough to just to keep ticking over. So a lot of Europe is now set up for a gas shortage this winter, and this is what Russia has done repeatedly in the past. They have shut off gas supplies to countries that they don't like in the middle of winter. And it's, you know, it's our way or freeze. And by creating this pipeline with Germany, they can do that now even more effectively. In the past, if Russia cuts off gas to Ukraine, they cut off gas to Austria and to Switzerland and to Italy and to all these other customers that get their Russian gas via Ukraine. By creating this pipeline, they can now shut off Ukraine, or they can shut off Poland, they can shut off any number of these other countries, while keeping that lucrative flow going and still keeping the cash coming in. So it makes it much, much easier. In addition to that, Russia pays Ukraine billions for the privilege of sending Russian gas through Ukrainian territory. They won't have to do that anymore, and that's a substantial chunk of Ukraine's revenue. So even if it's not a hard and fast our way or freeze, it can be a long-term strategy. If we can bankrupt your government, we can bring down governments that we don't like. You know, Poland is very aware of this. They have desperately been trying to create a gas pipeline that will bring much more expensive gas from Norway to Poland, because they want an outlet. And Russia, there's been all kinds of politics they want an alternative. And there's been all kinds of politics going on, where Denmark just this month has delayed that pipeline because of environmental concerns, even though Nord Stream 2 had far more environmental problems. There's all of this kind of politicking going on behind the scene. But then what this does is it also gives Germany then has that same power now, because they're the gas hub for all of Western Europe. And so, well, they could potentially do what Russia's been doing. At the same time, it just realigns the relationship between Germany and Russia. And this is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry focused on in his article, Germany and Russia's secret war against America. This is something that President Trump worked very hard to undermine. You know, NATO is designed to contain Russia, yet this just really binds Germany and Russia closely together. It makes Germany dependent on Russia. So how much are they going to be standing up to Russia? So more than just a case of this pipeline politics, it's also just a symbol of who's allied with whom. And it's a potent step for Germany outside of being an American ally and to being an independent actor or on the Russian side.
And I guess the other element of this, aside from the power this gives to Germany and to Russia, is the fact that the United States is enabling this. What do you make of the U.S. caving in so completely to Germany, and how do you view that in light of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, to me, the one thing that comes to mind is something else that Mr. Flurry has drawn a lot of attention to, going all the way back to the early 1990s, when Germany wanted to break up Yugoslavia, and America and Britain and pretty much the entire rest of the world was dead against it. Yet Germany got its way, and the result was a series of very destructive wars. But it's exactly the same dynamic, where I think it's almost inexplicable. It's very hard to see what rational purpose, what Germany could do to force America to capitulate. Apart from just America being incredibly weak, having that incredibly weak will. And when Germany, it doesn't always act with strength on the international scene, but there are some of these core things that it's very, very strong about, and it just about always gets its way on those. And that's, I think, a kind of a warning about this project. The fact that Germany has felt so strongly about it, that they're willing to stand up to just about anyone to make this happen, shows that this is much more than just an economic relationship.
You even wonder how much we've talked about just the corruption of Joe Biden and his family, and if there might be some things going on under the table, or some blackmail involved in some of these decisions. It's hard to say, but when you look at just how much the U.S. loses and how much these other nations gain, and really, again, pointing back to that article by Gerald Flurry about how Germany and Russia really are together undermining the United States' power in a lot of ways, you do wonder if there's more than meets the eye here. Well, we will link to this article by Mihailo Zekic on the website, U.S. Drops Opposition to Nord Stream 2. That is really on the front page right now. But we'll also link to Gerald Fleury's article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. A lot of important prophetic context in that article. And even his booklet, Germany Conquers the Balkans. Richard was talking about what happened in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. And that is crucial history to understand in order to get a better sense of what is happening, the relationship between the United States and Germany, and just how Germany is taking advantage of American weakness to increase its power. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Now to the Middle East. Iran has taken a huge step to increase the power of its oil economy and its control over the Strait of Hormuz. For this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
For some time, Iran has tried to figure out a way of potentially stopping the or blocking the Strait of Hormuz, which is one of the critical choke point for oil sales to get from place of supply to those that are buying. And it's wanted to find a way to be able to sabotage the oil going through there without hurting its own economy, because most of Iran's money comes from selling oil or other oil products in the open market. And this week, it achieved that ability with the opening of a new oil terminal that bypasses the Strait of Hormuz. This is a terminal that is in the Jask port, which is the Gulf of Oman, which is on the outside of the Persian Gulf. And there is a 600-mile pipeline that travels from western Iran all the way to this terminal, which will allow Iran from now on to gets its oil out to the open market without having to transit through the Strait of Hormuz. Now, at this time, there's only 350 barrels that were exported per day. It'll be ramped up to 1 million barrels per day. And so this only would account for about half of Iran's oil exports. Nevertheless, it is providing Iran with a lot of maneuverability to hit back at Western powers that really do desire or need oil from the Middle East, oil that transits through the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, Hormuz is about 25 miles across, which makes it a very easy target to sea mining or even attacks on ships going through there, which then could threaten the oil supply of Europe and Asia as well. So Iran is successfully giving itself the ability now, something it's desired for a long time, its ability to choke off the rest of the world, or at least oil sales through the Strait of Hormuz, but still allow its oil access to the open market.
Yeah, we've watched Iran monitoring the power that it has over this strait for quite some time, and Iran has actually threatened to close it on occasion and created problems for oil transiting through that choke point. The Iranian leadership was just absolutely ecstatic when they were announcing this new capability. Maybe you could just put it in context of not only what Iran has been aiming to do for quite some time, but what the Bible says and prophesies about what it will do in the future.
Right. So as you said, Iran has threatened to shut oil supply through here. And for the past couple of years, there's been British naval vessels and American naval vessels transiting the strait, along with commercial vessels, to ensure the Iranians don't try and sabotage or steal ships as they've done in the past. And this, you know, Iran has made its goals clear. They threatened to shut down the strait when U.S. President Donald Trump increased the sanctions on the Iranian oil sales as well. On Thursday, Rouhani, the outgoing president, he said this is a strategic move and an important step for Iran. It will secure the continuation of our oil exports. Then he says this: we had a terminal that is on the inside of the Persian Gulf, which means the oil had to go out through the Strait of Hormuz. He says we had a terminal, and if there was a problem, our oil exports would be cut off. Today is a great historic day for the nation. So basically he's saying if there was a problem, which everybody knows he's talking about, if there's a problem of our own making, if we decide one day to use the choking of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz as a political weapon against our enemies, then our exports will be cut off. But now we have the freedom to do that. This is indeed a historic day for the nation. And this is again, we've talked about one trend that we've watched for years regarding the Middle East, Iran's takeover of Iraq in the first half. And this is another one that we've been watching based on biblical prophecy, Iran's ability to sabotage world trade, and especially its ability to choke off or at least hold up oil exports, particularly to Asia, particularly to Europe, sorry, from the Middle East. And they have now really solidified their ability to do this. They already control the Bab al-Mandab Strait. That's on off the coast of Yemen. And so if you want to get from the Persian Gulf up into the Mediterranean, you've got to go via Yemen, and then you've got to go via the Bab al-Mandab, which Iranian-backed Houthis basically control that, and they can shut that down if they want via the arsenal of weapons they have. And then the other problem, the major one, though, was the Strait of Hormuz. They wanted to be able to stop that flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz without hurting themselves. Now they have that. And biblical prophecy talks about the nations that are going to be allied with Iran. And if you look at the map, in Daniel 11, verse 40 to 43, details the nations that are going to be allied to Iran as this king of the south that is going to have a lot of power to push at Europe, it says there, or the king of the north, as it says there in the prophecy. If you look at the nations that are mentioned there, they all form a part of, well, they all line the shoreline of the Red Sea and going into the southern Mediterranean. And so from that, from those nations, from those nations attached to the King of the South, Mr. Gerald Flurry has said that Iran is going to gain control over these very, very important gateways to oil going to Europe. You've got the Bab al-Mandab. Eventually, they're going to get a hold of the Suez Canal as well. And now they've got the Strait of Hormuz that they shut at will. Now, there are some other elements to this that are going to have to take place. This is very important that it shuts off the Strait of Hormuz. However, you still have Saudi Arabia that has an oil pipeline that gives it the ability to not put its oil through the Strait of Hormuz. They have one that actually makes its way into the Red Sea. And then you also have the UAE that have made its own pipeline as well that does not have to transit the Strait of Hormuz. Now, why have these nations, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, the adversaries of the Iranian regime, why have they made such an amazing outpouring of funding for these major pipelines that bypass the Strait of Hormuz? Because they know that Iran wants to do this. They saw that this has been Iran's policy to do this.
Right.
But we know based on biblical prophecy that those pipelines that they have will not be enough, because Iran is also going to get the strategic gateway of the Suez Canal as well. And so if you can think about three major choke points of Middle East oil getting to Europe, you've got the Strait of Hormuz, Bab al-Mandab, Suez Canal. Two of those now, Iran is able to shut down without hurting its own economy. This is a big step forward for Iran being able to fill its prophesied role as the king of the south that will eventually push at Europe. And oil, its control of European oil is most likely a big part of that push.
Definitely a situation that we need to keep our eyes on. It's amazing when you look back at thetrumpet.com and the Trumpet magazine, just how much we've written about the Strait of Hormuz and the danger that Iran poses there. In our show notes, we will link to an article that Brad McDonald, thetrumpet.com's managing editor, wrote back in 2012, Europe, Iran, and Bible Prophecy Come Alive in the Strait of Hormuz. And also we'll link to Gerald Flurry's booklet, The King of the South, that explains Iran's role in events in the Middle East. Both very, very worthwhile reads. So thank you very much for that, Brent. China has been accused of a massive amount of cyber espionage. To learn about this, we will go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was on Monday that the United States Justice Department charged a group of Chinese nationals with carrying out major cyber attacks against dozens of American companies, universities, and government bureaus. And these charges came the same day that America and a group of other nations formally accused China's Ministry of State Security with conducting a worldwide hacking campaign. This campaign included a major attack on Microsoft Exchange servers back in March and another recent attack on the Norwegian parliament. So this surge of Chinese attacks mostly targeted trade secrets in industries ranging from education and biopharmaceuticals to aviation, maritime transportation, and defense. So the Chinese are really stealing proprietary technologies in the most sensitive industries and sectors. And this report actually said that they were using more than 50 specific techniques. These Chinese hackers were using those routinely to carry out this theft. One part of the U.S. Justice Department report says, quote, "These criminal charges once again highlight that China continues to use cyber-enabled attacks to steal what other countries make in flagrant disregard of its bilateral and multilateral commitments." So, you know, the report is somewhat scant on details of what exactly China stole, but it is bold, I think, in at least a few of those statements. And it's significant that this was not just the United States, but also the governments of Australia, Canada, Germany, Japan, New Zealand, Norway, and the UK that issued this charge against China. So it's just a pretty impressive range of countries calling China out. But I think that Adam Segal, a cybersecurity expert with the Council on Foreign Relations, made a salient point about this. He said, "The fact that so many nations joined the U.S. in calling China out for its theft is a positive development, but, quote, the measure will not be very useful without any concrete follow-up."
Right.
So, you know, that's really what this comes down to. It's one thing to file charges and to wag your finger at the Chinese, but without a concrete follow-up, we shouldn't expect China to change its behavior at all.
Yeah, I mean, we read about these kinds of attacks taking place fairly routinely now, it seems, and yet consequences are not reported on. There really is no significant follow-up to this. How did China respond to these accusations?
Well, at first it was just the usual, you know, the adamant denials, the sanctimonious displays of shock that someone would dare accuse China of this. That's the sort of thing we've come to expect from the Chinese. But then on Wednesday, China went a notable step further, and they claimed that U.S. hackers have been attacking thousands of servers in China. And it's not that American hackers don't have the ability to wage that kind of attack against China, but I think the timing of this unsubstantiated Chinese accusation right after, you know, this coalition of nations accused them of illegal hacks, it just makes it look pretty pathetic, really. But Geopolitical Futures wrote about these developments this week, and they wrote, quote, "China and the U.S., to say nothing of Russia and countless non-state actors, have the capabilities to do enormous damage to each other using cyber weapons. This is likely to be a permanent point of tension going forward." So, you know, it is something that's becoming basically a permanent feature of the modern struggle for global power. And so far, China's winning. Even if you look just at the U.S., the estimates say China's theft is costing us between $225 billion and $600 billion each year. So just a stunning amount there. And then if you looked at the whole global picture, that amount that China is stealing would be hundreds of billions, maybe even trillions more.
Why is this significant prophetically?
Deuteronomy chapter 28 is an important Bible chapter that we come back to again and again. This is a chapter that discusses some particular ways that God said he would bless Israel if they obeyed him, and some particular ways he would punish Israel if they refused to turn to him. And Israel here refers mainly to the modern U.S. and Britain. But if you read this chapter, you'll see that one of those ways God said he would curse the U.S. and Britain is in verse 33. There it says, "The fruits of those countries' labor would be stolen and consumed by an enemy nation." And this is what's happening right now. America and Britain are rejecting God, and as a result, God is letting the fruits of their labors be just systematically stolen and consumed by a foreign power, exactly as he warned he would. So as disturbing as this trend is, I think we really shouldn't be all that shocked to see it happening.
We do have an article on thetrumpet.com about this. Jeremiah has written China's Global Hacking Spree, if you want to read more about this and the prophecies that he was talking about there. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Cuba's communist regime is facing massive public demonstrations against its failed system. The Biden administration stepped out to condemn that system, and that drew criticism from quite a number of U.S. politicians. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, after 62 years living under communism, Cubans are really getting fed up. You've had some huge historic demonstrations over the past week or so. Republicans have definitely taken the opportunity to condemn communism for Cuba's problems. The Democrats have taken a more divided approach, with those like Joe Biden and the more moderate ring of the party issuing a bit of a belated and half-hearted condemnation of communism. But with the more radical ring of the party, like Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, coming out and actually condemning the United States for the embargo against Cuba. And that probably shouldn't become as too much of a surprise, as both Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are self-avowed democratic socialist and big-time supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement. Two organizations, the Democratic Socialist of America and Black Lives Matter, who have come out in support of Cuba, not the protesters, but the government, with both of those institutions issuing statements of support. Now, here's actually, I brought a quote from the Black Lives Matter statement of support for Cuba, where it says, this is from the quote, it says, "Black Lives Matter condemns the U.S. federal government's inhumane treatment of Cubans and urges it to immediately lift the economic embargo. Cuba has historically demonstrated solidarity with oppressed peoples of African descent, from protecting black revolutionaries like Assata Shakur through granting her asylum, to supporting black liberation struggles in Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, and South Africa." Which is an interesting statement, because, I mean, if you've followed the Black Lives Matter movement much, Assata Shakur was a radical Black Panther in the 1970s who killed a New Jersey police officer, got herself on the FBI's most wanted list, fled America to communist Cuba, and has been living there to this day. And so this statement is basically like condoning her actions as like a revolutionary and a martyr against the U.S. government, who the Cubans are protecting. And all those African nations it lists are places that Cuba has financed and logistically supported communist revolutions. So this is really a full-throated statement from Black Lives Matter in support of not just the Communist Party of Cuba, but communist movements around the world.
Black Lives Matter, as much public support as it has gained and as mainstream as it has become over the past year in America and even globally, has been very upfront in its support of communism, just flat-out communism, that should be a lot more concerning to a lot of people.
Yeah, you'd think it would be, because I know during the George Floyd protests that caused so many millions of dollars of damage in America last summer, they estimate that up to 26 million people took place in those protests, which were organized and sponsored by Black Lives Matter. So this Black Lives Matter movement, definitely can hold claim to being the largest protest movement in American history. And yet, as I just quoted, I mean, they're overtly praising the Black Panthers, overtly praising Assata Shakur, overtly defending Marxist revolutions in Angola and Mozambique and other places. And this isn't like they're coming out of the closet this week, that they've been secret communist all along. The movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, was founded in 2013, and only 3 years after that, when Cuban dictator Fidel Castro died, they wrote a very gushing eulogy of Fidel Castro, praising all the good he'd done for Cuba, and likening the Black Lives Matter movement to Castro's movement that really started up working to overthrow the Cuban government in 1956, basically putting up Castro and his brother Raul and Che Guevara and other communist revolutionaries in Cuba as like movements that they want to aspire to be in America. And so you're not looking at a human rights movement trying to defend black people from police. This is really just a full-fledged revolutionary movement that wants to overthrow the U.S. government and replace it with a system like they have in Cuba. I mean, you can look at, just do a little bit of digging. You've got your 13 guiding principles of Black Lives Matter, which espouse globalism, collectivism, socialism, the destruction of the Western prescribed nuclear family. And then the movement for Black Lives has several demands, from the collective ownership of banks to progressive income tax, guaranteed minimal income, things that come directly from the planks of the Communist Manifesto. If you take a look at those 10 planks. And so that's really what America is dealing with, is its own Marxist insurgency. And that feeds into many Bible prophecies we've been watching in Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 and Isaiah 1 and verse 7, that talks about cities being burned with fire and a third of the people dying in civil war. I really recommend an article we'll put in the show notes from our editor-in-chief titled The Real Agenda Behind Black Lives Matter, that really goes into, in much more detail than we've had time today, the Marxist roots of this organization, and even the evil spiritual force behind it that's pushing it to go beyond even what the Communist Manifesto would call for.
All right, excellent. And in addition to Gerald Fleury's article, The Real Agenda Behind Black Lives Matter, we have the article that Andrew Miller wrote about this very subject, Black Lives Matter Praises Communism. We'll include that in the links to the show notes as well. Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, American and Iraqi officials plan to call for U.S. combat troops to leave Iraq by the year's end. The Biden administration telling Facebook what to censor, Russia's new stealth fighter, and the runaway inflation in America's economy. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The United States recently evacuated Afghanistan. Well, now arrangements are being made regarding a pullout of American troops from Iraq as well. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
On Thursday, there was an exclusive article written for the Wall Street Journal by Michael Gordon, and it details that there is about to be a statement from the United States and Iraq that is going to announce that U.S. combat troops will be leaving Iraq by the end of the year. There will be some forces that remain, it seems, at least at first, to help in intelligence and also some training. However, there will be no need for fighters. That's what the Iraqi foreign minister said to the Wall Street Journal. We do not need any more fighters because we have those, he said. And so now it looks like the United States is going to pull out its fighting force from Iraq. Now, this is very important because if you've been listening to us for any length of time, you know that this is one of the hallmark prophecies of Mr. Gerald Fleury, that American forces will vacate Iraq and that correspondingly Iraq will fall to Iran. Now, the American forces have been there since 2003, and then they vacate in 2011. In the absence of American forces, you had the rise of Islamic State. American forces came back to defeat Islamic State with the help of Shiite militias that answer to Iran. And now that the Islamic State is virtually gone, you've had increasing attacks on American soldiers inside Iraq. And this dangerous situation has been, we've reported on quite a lot, of the almost daily attacks against American forces inside Iraq at the hands of Iranian-backed militias operating inside Iraq. And now we have, I think we reported on that last week, now we have a statement from the U.S. and Iraq, the government, that the U.S. is indeed going to issue a statement that by the end of the year, their combat forces are gone from Iraqi territory.
This really all does point back to Iran, doesn't it? And it was really from the first days of America's infiltration into Iraq in 2003, nearly 20 years ago, that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, was talking about that very thing, that when we weakened Iraq by removing Saddam Hussein, that it was inevitable that it would fall to Iran, that Iran is really the king of the region, and that America's presence was really the only thing that was preventing a complete takeover of Iraq by Iran. And now we've just been kind of playing this waiting game for quite a long time. The idea that the United States would have an indefinite long-term presence in Iraq was never entirely tenable. It was just a matter of time before the United States created a vacuum that Iran would move into. And it has been doing so steadily over the last 18 years.
Yeah, and there have been, you know, there've been a lot of victories for U.S. forces, I would say, inside Iraq, going back to the success of the surge that took place in the mid-2000s. And really, when George W. Bush left office, he left Iraq in a pretty good state in terms of the support that the U.S. gave to the Iraqi government, that had a lot of support of the Sunnis in the western part of the country. And then when Barack Obama came in and removed those forces, it really did destroy a lot of those close relationships that were built, let's say, inside Iraq, of the anti-Iranian players, those that didn't want to see their country, the Iraqi nationalists. And so there has been a tug of war that's taken place with different American administrations, one that understood that if they vacated Iraq, Iran would take over, and other American administrations, Biden administration and Obama administration, that facilitated Iran's power hold in Iraq by fighting alongside the Shiite militias, be that against Al-Qaeda, and then latter day against the Islamic State. Now, Donald Trump did that as well. However, there was the very important statement that Donald Trump gave. I think it was on Christmas Day when he showed up at the massive air base that America developed inside Iraq, and he let slip a secret. He said that while the mission is there to counter the Islamic State right now, we're also here to keep an eye on Iran. So they had 5,000 troops there. Mm-hmm. And he said, our purpose in this is still why we are still in here right now. Yes, on paper, it's against the Islamic State. But we know that if we vacate, then Iran takes over. That's going to happen. And that's what we're seeing take place right now, with the United States basically kowtowing to the Iranians by saying, and this statement that comes out from the Wall Street Journal is very much in line with this, that it's saying that Iran, it's only a matter of time. We are taking our fighters out of the country right now, and then it won't be long before everyone vacates. And the Iraqi security forces, those inside Iraq that don't want to fall to Iran, they've got to be very upset at this decision. Mm-hmm. You're showing all your cards. Why would you show the enemy that you're planning to vacate? Just like what happened in Afghanistan over the past 6 months, expect to see increased attacks against the American forces there. Expect to see Iran take a firmer hold over Iraqi internal politics. This week, you had the leader of the Quds Force, the Iranian Quds Force, inside Iraq, meeting religious leaders in the city of Qom. And so Iran is showcasing that at the same time America's pulling out, we are dominant. And this, again, does fit with those forecasts from 20 years ago from Mr. Gerald Flurry that said that in the end, the United States will come out of Iraq, and that Iran will gobble it up as part of its growing power alliance in the Middle East. And if people want to read more about this, I really think they should read Mihailo Zekic's article. I think it was from last week or the week before. It's entitled Biden's America is Pulling Out of the Middle East. He focuses both on Afghanistan and now what is looking to be an impending Iraqi exit as well.
Yeah, it's really important to understand the Bible prophecies that underpinned that forecast that Gerald Flurry made when America first went into Iraq. I think at the time it was a very bold forecast. You think about all of the shock and awe and just how impressive that the use of force was by America at that time. But what's happened in Afghanistan, what's happening in Iraq, both show the limits of American power. But what's happening in Iraq, particularly the way that it points to Iran and that forecast that Gerald Flory made based on Daniel 11 and Iran being the king of the South, really is important for our listeners to pay attention to. So we will link to that article, Biden's America is Pulling Out of the Middle East. Do read that and acquaint yourself with those prophecies that informed that forecast by Gerald Flory. Thank you very much for that, Brent. This week, Joe Biden's press secretary made a stunning statement showing how the government is playing a direct role in social media companies, which are routinely censoring Americans' freedom of speech. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this came just over a week ago, where the White House press secretary, like you said, Jen Psaki, she was at a press briefing. And she talked about how important it was to stop, quote unquote, disinformation about COVID. And I think we've become very used to hearing the terms disinformation or misinformation. Sometimes they are used to describe things that are wrong. Sometimes they're just used to describe things that certain individuals don't like. But she said that we are in regular touch with these social media platforms. She talked about having a COVID-19 team. And then she said, we're flagging problem posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. So the White House there is going out and telling this private company, take that down. Don't allow things that that say this. And apparently Facebook is going along with it. It's a much cozier relationship between these tech companies than they have admitted to before. I think previously they... it's very clear that Facebook and the people that work at a lot of these places have a left-wing bias, and there's certainly been suspicion of cooperation. But this is a very clear example of where the two organizations now say that they're talking together and working together to control what people can say on these biggest internet platforms.
The defense that these companies have made is that we are a private company, and you know, any private company should be able to determine who says what on their platforms. The argument that is increasingly being made by conservatives is, no, these are not simply private companies. Because of the level of power that they have and their ability to determine what information Americans receive, whose voices are heard, and so on, puts them into a different category. What you have here shows a direct level of involvement by the government itself in what is presumably a private company that basically shoots the idea that they should have immunity from any kind of oversight completely out of the water.
Yeah, it just even, in some ways, it undercuts that whole debate and starts raising questions of, well, are they just a private company? Because... yeah, I mean, then you've got the government reaching out and doing this. I think it's an interesting situation now where you've got private companies doing the government's bidding, and because they're private governments, there are fewer checks and balances and protections on what they're doing than if it were the government itself. And you see this with free speech. You see this in, I think it was Morgan Stanley or one of these big banks, for example, has started requiring its staff get vaccinated. Just private companies doing things that governments wouldn't be allowed to do. Mm-hmm. And then when they're doing them in cooperation with the government, it's like an interesting way to find an end run around the Constitution.
Andrew Miller has actually written about just how much you have, say, former Barack Obama government officials getting jobs, high-paying jobs, high-profile jobs in many of these media companies, how much collusion there has been, even when you just look at the personnel that and the overlap between the Obama administration and these companies. Do you have any, can you add anything to that, Andrew?
Well, I know last I looked, there was at least 250 people who were either former Obama administration officials who left the Obama administration to work for Google, or former Google employees who left the Google company to work for the Obama administration. And that was some years ago. But yeah, there's been a number of media outlets that they have talked about what they call like the revolving door of people that just go from government to Silicon Valley to Silicon Valley to the government, and then sometimes even back again. So, yeah, they try to make the argument that, like, well, yeah, the private companies can do what they want, but like I said, a lot of it at times it is the same people working in both places, which just makes it that much easier for them to do things like Richard was mentioning, where the White House calls up an old friend, maybe even an old former colleague of theirs at Google, and been like, hey, this conservative outlet we don't like is saying this thing we don't like. Can you stop that for us?
Yeah. So, Richard, why is it so critical that we look at this? There are obviously a lot of people focusing on this. The Trumpet always looks at it from the lens of Bible prophecy. This is something that our editor-in-chief has really locked in on.
Yes, I mean, this is something that there's a lot of people concerned about. You don't have to be an expert. You know, you don't have to be really into Bible prophecy, I think, to be worried about what is happening here. The idea of a government that controls what can and can't be said online is something that is very disturbing. But then, yes, there are special things. You know, there's a special connection with Bible prophecy. And I do think it's fascinating. I just point to another article we had on our website this week. Amazon delivers almost every video to your screen, which was just really eye-opening for me, talking about how just one massive company controls way more than you would even think in terms of what people can say and read. But one very specific prophecy is in Amos chapter 7 and verse 10 that talks about a time period when God's word, when this message, when a message about the Bible, about Bible prophecy is shut out because people don't want to hear it. And in an era where you have lots of free speech protections and tons of ways to get your message out, that wouldn't be possible. But if a message is being able to shut down, well, there is a lot of censorship going on there. And you wrote an article about this back in October 2018, A Hit on Free Speech in America. And this is kind of when, at the beginning of this trend getting started, when they shut down Alex Jones, you know, not someone we would have a massive amount of in common or a sympathy for, but it was the start of an attack on free speech, and he was kind of like an easy target. And we've seen this just get so much worse since then. And you know, it ties very directly into those prophecies. It's something that we know is going to be affecting us, potentially even this program in time, and ties in with, you know, the whole kind of trend that Mr. Flurry's talked about as well in his book Great Again. And I think there's a new book coming out soon of just this attack on a lot of the values that have made the United States a great nation and a place where God's word has been able to go out.
Where would you send people for more information, Richard?
Yeah, well, that article, A Hit on Free Speech in America, is a good place to get a pretty quick overview of what is happening and why it's important.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Russia's military capabilities continue to advance, the latest example being the unveiling of an extremely sophisticated and impressive stealth fighter. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was on Tuesday that Russia's leading aircraft manufacturer unveiled a new supersonic fifth-generation fighter jet. And this is a very impressive warplane that's expected to be able to rival even the U.S.'s F-35 fighter jets, which are the most advanced jets that America has. This new Russian jet is called the Checkmate. That name, I think, signifies just a lot of confidence and even a confrontational kind of motivation that's behind this. And the Checkmate does have all the features that will put it in an elite class of lethality. It's got the short takeoff capability, internal weapons bay. It can get up to speeds of Mach 2. It has a range of almost 1,800 miles. And then the total payload capacity is over 16,000 pounds. So just a remarkably sophisticated and capable jet. And Russia is already announcing that they'll be selling them to China, India, and Vietnam. And for a country like Vietnam, especially, that has wanted to buy America's F-35s but never has because of the price tag, the Checkmate is especially enticing because they're far more affordable than the F-35s, even though they are viewed as a rival to them. So it's still a few years from being officially launched, but the Checkmate is being rapidly developed, And I think this is just one more big sign of Russia's increasing determination to dominate the skies and to assert its power more boldly.
So Russia is, we've talked about several military advancements that it has made, including to its nuclear program. It's working multidimensionally, cyber attacks and other areas. How do you view this from a prophetic perspective?
Well, that's a great question, because I think sometimes it's easy to only see these kinds of arms developments as a situation of kind of the U.S. and Russia competing in trying to sort of outdo each other. But when you look at this through the lens of Bible prophecy, you see that the more important region to watch for a response to Russia's increases in military might is Europe. Several European nations, especially in Eastern Europe, have suffered just terribly at the hands of Russian soldiers in the past. And now the people of those European nations are just very concerned by Russia's rise and its increasing aggression with, you know, taking parts of Europe as it did with the Crimean Peninsula a few years back, and with Russia's military advancements, such as with this remarkably advanced new Checkmate warplane. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has addressed this on a few occasions. One of those was in an article that he wrote just after Russia had annexed Crimea. At that time, Mr. Fleury wrote, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." So really, that's at the heart of it. The Europeans certainly remember Russia's acts of aggression on Ukraine. They see Putin's expanding firepower with things like this new warplane, and all of that fear of Russia that is now intensifying among Europeans is just strengthening their desire to unify Europe, both politically and militarily.
Well, if you would like more information about that, you can read Gerald Fleury's article, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." We'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We'll finish with America's economy as government spending contributes to runaway inflation. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, you may want to get groceries this weekend because the price of food and many other commodities is set to climb higher and higher. One billionaire owner of a supermarket chain in America even predicted that he thinks inflation on food will be up to 10 to 14% by the end of this year, with inflation overall being about 6%. And we've covered, I think, on this program before that even those numbers could be artificially low. John Williams at Shadow Statistics has reported that if inflation were calculated the same way today as it were during the Carter administration, it would already be 13%.
Wow.
And set to go higher. It's a big enough crisis that, I mean, people are talking about it, and now even Joe Biden's seen fit to come out and address it, giving a press conference in the White House on Monday, talking about how it's vital that America tamp down inflation by having Congress pass his $3 trillion spending bill to update America's infrastructure and social safety net as fast as possible, which is one of the stranger things Joe Biden has said, which is saying something, in that the fact that, like, this $3 trillion spending bill is like, maybe it will increase employment in America, but there's no parallel universe where spending more money that you don't have is going to tamp down inflation. I mean, even elementary school mathematics will tell you that, like, the U.S. GDP is approximately $20 trillion. So that's what our economy is worth. The more dollars you print, the more slices you cut in that pie, each slice getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So you can run a $3 trillion deficit, but you basically just cut 3 trillion more slices in the same pie, each slice representing a dollar and being worth just a little bit less than it was, or in this case, maybe a little more than a little bit less than it was before. So we have an article put in the show notes that went up on our website this week entitled "Joe Biden's Spending Spree Will Hurt Your Wallet." That goes through the news I just covered, and then points people to statements Mr. Armstrong had made even back in the 1970s about getting ready to reduce your standard of living, because as his book "The United States and Britain in Prophecy" pointed out, America is prophesied to decline, and economic decline will factor into that overall decline in a big way. Which means problems like employment, uninflation, other things like this are going to get worse and worse, and America is not going to enjoy the world's highest standard of living. Actually, no longer has the world's highest standard of living, but it will get worse and worse, and the people going into this are going to have to prepare to do more with less. But
Biden's spending will hurt your wallet is the name of the article that we will point to. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Edison: "Our greatest weakness lies in giving up. The most certain way to succeed is always to try just one more time." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.